From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Governor Whitmer thinks it's like something fished out of Governor Snyder's trash can, but is there momentum for the latest road funding idea? Plus, why nearly a third of counties in Michigan are high risk when it comes to opioids.
Metropolitan counties were actually at higher risk, which was a surprising finding. We were expecting to find rural counties.
A community says no to a proposed power plant, but
Novi Energies, they just keep sending them and other board members these letters saying, this plant's going to be great for the community. And once everyone understands that, they're going to put out the welcome mat.
And the All-American Girls Baseball League.
The first team that Michigan had were the Grand Rapids Chicks. We then had the Muskegon Lassies, who then turn into the Kalamazoo Lassies. And then we have the Battle Creek Bells, who eventually turn into the Muskegon Bells.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A new U of M study identified the counties in Michigan where resources are most needed to combat the opioid crisis. We'll find out where and what can be done later in the hour. But first, Governor Whitmer this week said a new GOP plan to find money for road repairs was, I'm quoting here, maybe retrieved out of Governor Rick Snyder's trash can. She's talking about the new proposal from the West Michigan Policy Forum. Their idea, pay for road repairs by borrowing against the teacher pension plan. Chad Livengood of Crane's Detroit Business is with us. Chad, in the plainest of terms, what is this proposal from the West Michigan Policy Forum?
It's a proposal to borrow $10 billion and pump it into the pension fund so it can be invested and lower the unfunded liability of the $50 billion pension fund for 400,000 school employees who are retired or active workers. And then at the end of the day, it's supposed to free up money. Basically, right now we're on a 20-year payment plan for this pension fund. They want to spread out to 30 years. So it's just the easiest way to think about it is if you had a mortgage you owed 20 years on and you got a new mortgage and you owed it for over 30 years, you would lower your yearly payment. You may pay more in the long run, but you're lowering the payment so you can free up money. That is essentially the idea here, to free up something in the neighborhood of $1 billion that could be cash used to eventually make its way to roads. It's a little complicated.
Yeah.
like all these things in high finance. And this is why Governor Gretchen Whitmer has been trying to push for just a straight 45-cent gas tax increase, because it's one vote, as she says, a one historic vote. And rather than having all these kind of different accounting gimmicks and levers you'd have to pull in order to open up the state treasury to create more money to fix roads.
So the West Michigan Policy Forum is a group of prominent business leaders, and former Speaker of the House Jace Bolger is a political consultant for this group. He was on Stateside a couple weeks ago selling this plan as a viable solution for roads and disagreeing with critics who say borrowing against teacher pensions is risky.
Pension obligation bonds have not worked for some entities, but that is because they've done it for the wrong reasons. They've done it because they can't make their payment. They've done it because they're in trouble and they must get a massive arbitrage, is what it's called, a massive investment over their interest payment. This would be for a different purpose, different reason, different assumptions, and therefore I think it's at much less risk.
Chad, what do GOP leaders in the legislature like about this plan?
Well, they like that it opens up some new money, and what they're really trying to do is solve the problem that Jace Bolger himself couldn't solve as Speaker, and that is remove the sales tax on gasoline. This 6% that everyone pays on top of the 20 some odd cents that you pay for gasoline, that does not go to roads, and that really irks drivers a lot that money is diverted, and most of that money goes to schools. So what they're trying to do here is figure out a way to free up money so they can remove that sales tax on gasoline, raise the gas tax by the same amount so it's revenue neutral, doesn't actually increase overall taxes, and then replace the revenue with the savings created by this pension bond idea. The complications with this is that you, as the speaker noted, you've got to earn more than the interest payment on the bonds. I mean, the interest payment, say it's 4%. You have to always, over 30 years, earn more than 4%. And as we saw in 2008, 2009, there were some 401ks and some pension systems in the state that took 20 to 25%. 20% haircuts in a matter of a couple of months in the fall of 2008. And so that is the concern. Now, we have one glaring example in Michigan that I could point to, mm-hmm. and that was the city of Detroit. Kwame Kilpatrick in 2004-2005 got the city council of Detroit to issue a little different type of debt called pension obligation certificates, where they basically were IOUs, but it was the same kind of thing, a bond of sorts, that they essentially then turned and put the money into the pension funds at the height of a good market. And within a few years, in the crash of 08 and 09, they lost almost all that money. And that pension debt deal was what precipitated Detroit's bankruptcy, filed 6 months ago this month.
Anniversary there. Boy, you know, it strikes me as something my grew up on a farm mother used to say, borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. Who are the critics and what are they saying?
Well, people out in the municipal finance world are pretty skeptical of pension bonds. The Government Finance Officers Association has warned against them. They're really kind of seen as they're frowned upon really in the finance world. Even though there's been some encouragement of this, have been used also to pay down unfunded retiree health care. Oakland, Macomb County, and a bunch of counties out in West Michigan have done that in recent years. But, there's a lot of skeptics. A conservative economist, Patrick Anderson of the Anderson Group in East Lansing, he calls this a Chicago-style pension holiday, and essentially trying to equate that it is a sort of financial gimmicks that they do over in Illinois, except Chicago looked at this. Rahm Emanuel, the former mayor of Chicago, wanted to issue $10 billion of his own pension bonds last year, and they backed away from it when they realized that their interest rate was probably going to be higher than the return they could yield on the market long term. So that's the big risk, is that you have to beat the market, and it's a big bet, and we're talking about a big bet on the financial future of well over 250,000 retired school teachers.
In our final seconds, Chad, politics. Will we see the GOP push hard for this, and could Governor Whitmer live with it?
Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky told me this will be part of his plan that they will present as part of a larger finance and funding plan on roads they'll present later this summer. Governor Whitmer, she's already pretty much poo-pooed it. She said it's something she noted that, former Governor Rick Snyder rejected a similar plan, and that, as you mentioned at the top of your segment, that this was essentially retrieved from Rick Snyder's trash can.
And as a matter of fact, his aide Dennis Muchmore seconded that and said, yes, he did look at it, and it was pretty quickly dismissed. Chad Livengood, Crane's Detroit Business. Always great talking with you. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
A grassroots group that's fighting a proposal to build a massive gas power plant has won an important battle. Citizens to Keep Rives Rural wants to keep Novi Energy from building an 1,800-megawatt plant in Rives Township, a rural area north of Jackson known for its horse farms. Last night, the township board approved a six-month moratorium on building new fossil fuel power plants. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samuelton's been following all of this. Let's start at the beginning for folks that have not heard about this. I understand at first the elected leaders of Rives Township were open to the idea of the plant?
That's right. Way back in 2017, I think, a representative of Novi Energy met with Rives Township Planning Commission Chairman Roger DeCamp and the township supervisor Jerry Adams, and they all went to this farm where the owners had agreed to sell the property to Novi. And these two gentlemen said, oh, sounds like a good idea, more property taxes. But here is kind of where the theme of this whole story in my mind is coming up. Do you know that famous line in Cool Hand Luke about communication?
Oh, Strother Martin's line, what we've got here is failure to communicate.
That is correct. So the Novi Energy guy didn't tell Mr. Adams and Mr. DeCamp that the previous owner had basically kicked him off the property, saying, I'm not going to betray my neighbors by selling this property. But when he died, his family invited Novi Energy back, And so after this meeting, they didn't know that. After this meeting, the Planning Commission, it was right in the middle of working on a new master plan. And it just drew this blue line around the farm on a draft of the master plan and indicating it was going to be rezoned industrial.
Without telling the community.
That's right. And that's when all heck broke loose. A grassroots group was formed, Citizens to Keep Rives Rural, and they start to show up to township board meetings and planning commission meetings, demanding immediate action to keep this plant out. And this is how Supervisor Adams described it to me.
Early on, they were very, very, very upset. And I get it. You know, there was no information, and they were coming to us for information, and we had no information.
So very upset, I think, is maybe putting it mildly. I would call it irate. So Mr. Adams begins writing to Novi Energy, and he's saying, hey, people really hate this idea, and we've changed our minds, and could you please just go away? And so here's the failure to communicate thing. Novi Energy is like, they just keep sending him and other board members these letters saying, this plant's going to be great for the community. And once everyone understands that, they're going to put out the welcome mat for us.
Now, Tracy, you've talked to Megan Short, who's the leader of Citizens to Keep Rives Rural. Now, what have she and other members of this group been doing besides going to township meetings?
I think it's what they have not been doing is the question. Oh, my gosh. They've been contacting environmental groups and lawyers and getting documents from MISO. That's the grid operator that's doing a connection study for Novi Energy and researching Novi Energy and sending FOIAs. And Ms. Short says there is going to be no welcome mat. But she also says that the township can't afford to wait until Novi Energy actually puts in an application.
We feel at any point they're going to come in. When they come back to the township, they're going to have everything they need. They're going to have their site plan. They're probably going to have their draft permits. They're going to have their generation study results. They're going to know exactly what they need, what they want, and they're going to expect it handed to them on a silver platter.
So there's this six-month moratorium now. What does Novi Energy say?
Failure to communicate. I've emailed them. I've called them several times over the past few weeks. I also emailed and called today, and I have not heard back from them at this point.
Keeping an eye on this fascinating back and forth in Rives Township. Tracy Sambleton, thank you.
You're welcome.
Coming up, as the U.S. women's national soccer team celebrates its fourth World Cup victory, we look at the Michigan history of female pro athletes from a different sport, baseball. That's after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is Wednesday. You know that means it's time to talk some history with our partners at the Michigan History Center and the stunning success of the U.S. women's national team at the World Cup, winning their fourth cup. That got us thinking of women making sports history 70 years ago. We're thinking of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League.
We're the members of the All-American League. We come from cities.
That, of course, is from the 1992 Penny Marshall film, A League of Their Own, the film inspired by the early days of All-American women's baseball. Rachel Clark, Michigan History Center, how and why did this league get launched in 1943?
In 1943, or by 1943, the world was in the thick of World War II, and most men in the United States were either in war or doing war work. And baseball owners created this new professional league with women to sort of keep baseball going and keep it in the public eye, but also to keep people's morale up.
And I know that A League of Their Own is fictionalized, but so much of that is included in the film. So anyone who saw that, and of course, we all know there's no crying in baseball. So how many teams were there? And do we know how many women played between 1943 and 1954?
Over the course of the league's existence, there were 15 cities that had teams. And like baseball today, you get teams that shift from one city to the next or get sold or whatever. So at any given season, you had up to 9 teams. But it started out with just a few teams. They tried out about 280 women and took 60 for that initial set of teams.
And I understand the teams were mainly in the Midwest. What did we have in Michigan?
Michigan had a few teams, the Grand Rapids Chicks, and I'm not a fan of these names. But
well, again, let's remind everybody, we're talking about the 1940s. Yes. All right.
So the first team that Michigan had were the Grand Rapids Chicks, and they actually lasted from 1945 to 54. So they were the longest running team in Michigan. We then had the Muskegon Lassies, who then turned into the Kalamazoo Lassies. And then we have the Battle Creek Bells, who eventually turn into the Muskegon Bells. So you do have this shift of teams, but Michigan was well represented.
What were the schedules like?
The schedules were not as sort of crazy as the men's schedules, but in 1943, they played 108 games, which is considerably fewer than men. But if you think about it, they only had half a dozen teams to start with. They were playing all the time, all over the Midwest. It was a really busy schedule. They were all over.
And I'm curious whether was the game different for these women of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League than it would be for the men?
This is where I start to laugh when you look at how the rules change and the game changes. Initially, it was a hybrid sort of between baseball and softball. The ball was more like a softball to start with. The pitcher's mound was only 40 feet away from home plate, which is freakishly close. If you're a pitcher, that's going to make you really nervous. And so eventually, though, they realize that these women can play and they're very good. And so the game starts to shift in the mid-1940s. The ball gets smaller. The length between bases gets longer. The pitching distance gets longer. And they turn into overhand pitching. So by the final season, you get what looks more like a women's baseball game as opposed to a softball game.
Fair enough. And I'm very interested in how were they received by the public? I mean, if we saw a league of their own, we kind of see at the beginning the stands are empty. But of course, by the big championship game at the end, it's jammed. But so how did the public receive these girls out there playing baseball?
They received them actually very well. That's one of the ways the movie is a little off. In its initial season, the league recorded 176,612 fans at their games. So it was always, obviously, you're going to have people who were skeptical, but it was very well received. And the games typically were packed. Hmm. And they continued to be that way just about up until the end of the league.
What about pay? We're certainly hearing about that with our U.S. women's national team with the World Cup win and the pay issue. How did the women's pay compare to the men's?
Compared to the men's, if you look at the men's pay in the 1940s for baseball, it was sort of all over the place. You get somebody like Joe DiMaggio, who's paid, I think, $37,000 for his 1941 season. That's a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
But they were actually, if you're looking at average household income, the women were paid quite well. Hmm. They were paid in 1943 anywhere from $45 to $85 a week, which converts to anywhere from $600 to $1,200 a week.
Yeah.
And then it continues, the pay increases, but with inflation, the value of that pay doesn't really increase. But a lot of these girls are actually paid, and women were paid better than their parents. So they're living wage, it is a living wage, and they are paid actually quite well.
So the war ends in 1945, but the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League goes until 1954.
Oh, yeah, it continues. Each year, the teams, they increase the number. This is where your Michigan teams come in the late 40s. Post-World War II, and then they're traveling more. They go to Cuba for a tour. The rules are changing to make the game more exciting. The popularity does continue into the 50s. It starts to decline a little bit. The league itself becomes decentralized. The marketing changes. Cities don't want to pay for their share of it. In the beginning, Philip Wrigley, who's the Cubs owner, agrees to pay half of the cost of the team, and then whatever municipality has the team, they pay the other half. That changes. Then you also get TV, and you get TV is broadcasting games in people's homes. So things start to change in the 50s, and that just sort of leads to the decline of the league.
You have to wonder, why, as we see the U.S. women's soccer team getting so much attention. I mean, these women are rock stars in the sports world, but the U.S. women's baseball team is basically invisible on the world stage. Why is that, do you think?
Women's baseball is sort of this unique, almost weird thing in the United States. It's vastly popular in East Asia. Japan and China, women's baseball teams over there do quite well. In the United States, with Title IX in 1972, softball is sort of looked at as an equivalent to baseball, and it's not. They're totally different games. But girls' sports teams, if you want to play baseball, girls can in Little League. There was a 1973 lawsuit actually in Michigan that opened the path for girls to play Little League baseball. But after that, if you want to play in high school, girls have to play softball because it is seen as equivalent to baseball. Girls can play soccer. Girls can play, you know, basketball. There are other sports in high school that are the same, men versus women. Softball is sort of this unique thing. There isn't a pathway to women's baseball for young girls. They have to go through softball, and they're different games. You cannot really look at those two things and say they are the same thing. So it never, women's baseball doesn't catch on in this country, sort of because of that weird softball-baseball comparison.
Interesting. Yes. Just compared to, just thinking of the way women's soccer and the fact that they are the stars.
Yes. proud of them. I am so proud of them.
Well, I know you watched with special interest because you played in school, right?
I did.
You made it to the state finals?
We did. My high school team made it to the state finals, and I am old enough that my high school team was actually one of the early high school girls teams to make it to the state finals.
All right, shout out for your high school.
Okemos High School, class of 1991.
Yeah, okay, and what happened when you got to the finals?
We got absolutely hammered by Troy Athens, but it was a great run. We had a lot of fun. Our goal every year that I played high school soccer was to just get past East Lansing. That was the big one. And my senior year, for a reason, we had the right combination of players, and we made it to the state finals, and then got killed. That's okay.
Wonderful walk through history in women's sports with Rachel Clark, Michigan History Center, Okemos, class of 91, who made it to the state soccer finals. Thanks so much, Rachel.
Thank you very much.
As Michigan joins with the nation seeking solutions to the mounting opioid crisis, researchers at the University of Michigan have come up with an important tool for policymakers and leaders. It's a study that identifies some of the highest risk counties battling the opioid epidemic, and that includes nearly a third of counties in Michigan. Rebecca Haffagee is an assistant professor of health management and policy at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Rebecca, you studied 3,142 U.S. counties. What makes a county high risk? What information did you use to identify a county as high or low risk?
We developed a measure for this high risk that identified counties that both had high opioid overdose mortality rates and had low capacity to treat opioid addiction. The reason that that was important is because these medications and treatments for opioid addiction can vastly reduce mortality by 40 to 50%. So we wanted to come up with a combined measure of what counties had both risk factors and understand which counties these are and what characteristics they have.
That makes a county high risk.
Mm-hmm.
So what were the key findings of your study?
We identified a number of regions and states that had a number of counties that were high risk. Michigan was among them, as you said, mm-hmm. about a third of counties in Michigan we identified as opioid high risk. Other states within the Midwest region also had a number of high risk counties, like Illinois and Indiana as well. And then a number of counties in the South, North Carolina, Virginia, Kentucky.
So let's talk about Michigan. How do we compare nationally?
Yeah, Michigan had some of the highest rates of high-risk counties. And so what that tells us is that despite having high overdose mortality here, and we've been among the top, 15 states in that in the country for many years now, that we haven't caught up in terms of having enough treatment providers to try to mitigate those risks.
All right. What are some of the counties in Michigan at highest risk?
They're scattered around, some around Detroit area, Wayne County, for example, some others, Huron County, Genesee, Livingston, Macomb. I mean, there are 24, mm-hmm. so there are quite a few. They were mostly in the Lower Peninsula. There were a few counties we couldn't identify as high or low risk in the Upper Peninsula because they have low populations, so we didn't have the death counts for those counties.
Are you able to say whether rural counties or urban counties mm-hmm. overall had a higher risk in terms of the opioid epidemic?
So we found rural counties in particular didn't have a lot of treatment providers. So 71% of rural counties lacked any publicly listed treatment provider. So if you went and you tried to look up if they had a treatment provider of any of the three dominant medications for opioid use disorder or opioid addiction, they had none as of the end of 2017. But when we compare that with the overdose mortality risk as well, we found actually interestingly that metropolitan counties were actually at higher risk, which was a surprising finding. We were expecting to find rural counties.
You would think just based on it takes longer to get an ambulance to you and get you to a treatment center.
Yes, yeah. And so part of that, I think, is because we used the most updated death data we could, so 2015 through 17. Some of what we were picking up was the increased risk in metropolitan or urban areas because of fentanyl and the synthetics. So those drugs have really penetrated those urban settings in more recent years and are causing a lot of deaths. So what that tells us is there's spikes in deaths in those areas. And even though they have some treatment providers, they don't have enough to try to mitigate those harms.
So how'd we get here? Why is this, do you think? I know you've got the data, you've thought about this. How do you think we got to this point with so many places in our state and our country that don't have enough treatment providers?
There's a lot of barriers for prescribing these medications. They're heavily regulated, both at the federal and state levels.
And these would be the treatments?
These are the treatments like methadone, buprenorphine. The third medication we also included was naltrexone, which is a newer non-opioid treatment. So that one's not as heavily regulated, but it also isn't used as much, and it doesn't have quite the evidence base that the other two do in terms of efficacy and effectiveness. So they're heavily regulated. For example, for buprenorphine, which is by far the drug that has the potential for the most expansion because any primary care physician can prescribe that, but they have to get a waiver before doing so. So they have to go through 8 hours of training to actually prescribe that, which it's considered to be a bit of a hypocrisy because to prescribe any opioid analgesic, all you need is a controlled substance license and you don't need to jump through these additional hoops.
But to
yet,
provide
when we
the medication
treat,
that could treat
yes,
this.
That could actually help people, there are further barriers. Other persistent barriers are a lack of institutional support and peer support. A lot of prescribers want to make sure that they're not the only prescriber in a practice that is treating this patient panel and population because it can be a challenging population. They want to have backup support. They also want other providers like social workers and other case managers, that sort of thing, to help manage that patient caseload. And there's just not enough of all of those. Also, those other services aren't reimbursed very well. And then on the other side is insurance. They have some barriers like prior authorization or other hoops you have to jump through to get reimbursement for actually providing these treatments.
These are all things that you're talking. Yeah, lots of barriers that are not obvious to the average person.
Yes.
This is really going into the thickets for providers, for doctors, dealing with insurance companies, things that most people don't know.
Yes.
What do you want to be done with this research? Who are you aiming this at?
Largely federal, but mostly state policymakers. So states get these large amounts of grants from the federal government, and they have some of their own in their own budgets. But for example, the opioid strategic targeted response grants for the opioid crisis. So Michigan gets $16.4 million approximately a year just for the opioid crisis at the state level. And then they can target it at different localities depending on what they think the best use of those funds are. We wanted those policymakers to see, okay, these are the high-risk counties within our states where we need to be funneling more resources. We need to target some of these risk factors. And so other risk factors we found, like characteristics of these counties, not just the counties themselves, but also what were characteristics of them, where they had low employment, they had low primary care physicians, which goes to what we were talking about before, that there's not enough people that are entering this space and treating patients in this space. Some of those factors that they could actually address those risk factors. So come up with employment strategies for people in recovery, come up with ways to incentivize doctors to actually want to, and other care providers, to want to prescribe these medications and to do so in those areas.
And enact policy changes that might remove some of the hoops, these hoops
yes.
you're describing?
Yes, exactly that too. So think about why might people not be able to access these treatments under insurance in these locales, for example. So try to address these barriers and really target the money in the most effective ways because there's a limited pot of money to put towards this crisis and we want to make sure we're making the best use of those funds.
Does it feel like you're on the front line kind of fighting this wildfire, this health crisis that we have in our nation?
It does. It's unusual sometimes to be in a research area that is so in demand and where we need questions so quickly for what do we do. I also study a lot of prescribing policies and try to do evaluations. And one of the challenges there is a lot of these policies are being put into place so quickly and all at the same time states are often actually, in some areas, not in terms of treatment so much, but I think in terms of prescribing, ahead of the evidence. So they're doing a lot of policies and flurrying to try to do something, but we don't yet have a great sense of what definitely works, what are the unintended consequences of some of these policies as well. In many ways rewarding, but also challenging research space to be in for that reason, because we do have a need for answers now, but we also have data limitations in how quickly we can do these studies and how much recent data we have.
Rebecca Haffagy is an assistant professor of health management and policy at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. The recent study identifying some of the highest risk counties battling the opioid epidemic in this nation. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And our reminder, we love to hear from you. What stories are you focusing on, or issues or people that you want to hear more about? Just let us know. You can find us on Facebook by searching for Michigan Radio. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And as always, MichiganRadio.org, and click the link that says Stateside. Coming up, a recent analysis by the Detroit Free Press found that while student populations are getting more diverse, their teachers are still, by and large, white. And that's true even in districts serving mainly students of color.
It matters who's telling the story. If the same people are telling the story, then we're going to get the same story.
That is after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of America's most famous troubadours, Woody Guthrie.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Woodrow Wilson Guthrie, born in Oklahoma on July 14, 1912. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is here with us. A famous, famous life and a very long and sad death.
It was. He really was one of America's great troubadours and social activists and folk singers and writers. And he had Huntington's chorea, as it was called, or Huntington's disease. It's an autosomal dominant disease.
What does that mean?
That is a gene that is dominant. So when it meets a recessive gene, it takes over. And when a parent has that gene and disease, the child has a 50% chance of inheriting it. And he did. His mother died of Huntington's disease.
Yes.
And it's a slow, awful death. The gene that codes for it produces an abnormal protein that attacks brain cells and causes paranoia, psychosis, insanity, as well as movement disorders, trouble walking or having balance problems. And chorea, C-H-O-R-E-A, is an old-fashioned doctor's term for jerky movements of the arms and legs that are uncontrollable.
Okay. And I've got to imagine, as you say, he inherited this. Mm-hmm. His mother, Nora Bell Guthrie, had
right.
it. And it seems pretty clear doctors didn't know what to do with that or what she had, because did I read she was committed to the Oklahoma Hospital for the Insane when
yes.
Woody was 14?
Yes. And, you know, this amalgamation of epileptics, insane, those with cognitive disabilities, they're all lumped together. Well into the 50s and 1960s, frankly. And as psychiatry evolved and we got better understanding of neurologic diseases and primarily genetic diseases, because everybody knew that Huntington sort of ran in the family, but they didn't understand yet. Scientists had not yet identified the gene. That wasn't until the 1980s. And so now people who are children of Huntington's disease have a big decision to make of getting tested, because let's say you are positive. Mm. Well, by the time you're in your 30s or 40s, you are going to show these symptoms. And then it's a slow, inexorable, awful death.
What about for Woody Guthrie? How did the disease progress? I mean, I'm wondering, as it went through, was he still working and writing and performing?
He was. I mean, he was for a while. Woody was a big drinker. He liked a good friend of John Barleycorn. And for a lot of his early symptoms in his late 30s, early 40s, he attributed it to booze. And he drank a lot. And, you know, there are a lot of symptoms you can get from chronic alcoholism that are not dissimilar. You know, the movement disorders, thinking and brain disorders. And, of course, you get into a lot of trouble. And you could have balance problems if you're drunk. And the doctors that he saw just didn't know what was going on. He also had real paranoia. And violent spells. His wife, Marjorie, in the early 1950s, was told, divorce him and take the kids with you. And she did because you could never tell if he was going to get violent. And he felt terrible, of course, about this after the fact, but they were just uncontrollable rages. And then slowly and slowly, as the 50s progressed into the early 60s, there was less and less cognition. At first, he could respond to flashcards that said yes or no. Later, his wife said he could blink in response to things, but he was trapped in his body and could not get out.
And there was politics involved here, too. You write about the fact he had the added problem that J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI were leaning on his doctor.
Yeah, so Woody Guthrie was a card-carrying communist. He was a left of the lefties. And, you know, a lot of his songs are really, you know, protest songs against the man. Even This Land Is Your Land was a response to the hyper-patriotic song God Bless America. A colleague of mine, Michael Schoenfeld, just told me the original title was God Bless America for Me before he changed it to This Land Is Your Land. And so the FBI had been following him for years. And then after 1952, when he was released from a state mental hospital in New York, they started querying his doctors and ordered his doctors to violate patient confidentiality to cover and document his symptoms from Huntington's disease under the guise that he was a national security threat. He might have been able to hit somebody with his guitar, but I don't think he was a national security threat.
And when did he die? So how many years did he live with this disease before it was over?
Yeah, he died on October 3rd, 1967. And he probably started having symptoms in the late 1940s. You tend to die within about 15 to 20 years after diagnosis. That was in the olden days when they didn't have the genetic screening test for it. You could conceivably be diagnosed as a baby today.
Yes.
Yeah. So, he lived a while, but it wasn't a good life. That part of his life wasn't good.
And he had eight children. Did any of them develop this?
His two daughters from his first marriage died of Huntington's disease. He had a son who died in a car crash. Most famously, people worried about Arlo Guthrie, who was a folk singer and carried on in his father's footsteps. He was also Marjorie's son. And there was great talk of what he should do. And that's when they knew about the gene. And he did not get the test. And thankfully, he does not have it. He's still alive and working.
Is there anything we know today in 2019 to at least maybe perhaps slow the progression or ease symptoms?
There are a few things here and there, but it's still a very deadly disease and an awful one at that. And so, you know, the hope is that they could do something to prevent this particular gene from coding for this abnormal protein. And I suspect in the years to come that gene editing may be the solution, but we're not there yet.
Woody Guthrie, born in Oklahoma on July 14th, 1912. U of M medical historian and PBS contributor, Dr. Howard Markell, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
The focus on diversity, or lack of it, in our schools has centered largely on the students. But what about teachers? A recent analysis by the Detroit Free Press found that while student populations are getting more diverse, their teachers are still, by and large, white. And that's true even in districts serving mainly students of color. Well, let's discuss with Michigan Radio's education commentator and National Hall of Fame teacher Matinga Ragatz, who's with us via Skype. The Free reports that Michigan student population is 18% African American, while only 6% of our public school teachers are Black. Why is there such a large gap?
Well, this is a factor that is just multifaceted. Historically, of course, you know, Brown versus Board, many of the white schools did not hire Black teachers. You know, so Black teachers found themselves dismissed or demoted, or they were forced to resign because they were not being hired in the mostly white schools during desegregation.
So we're talking 60 years ago.
And, for sure. Yeah. And we just have not recuperated from that. The Michigan schools are still highly segregated, like you said, and Black teachers are often in hard to staff schools, which often have still less resources and have more socioeconomic issues. And, you know, for example, in some of the schools in Michigan, teachers don't have prep hour. They don't have an hour to collaborate with their peers or grade papers. So it's a very difficult place to be.
And it sounds like there could certainly be easily burnout.
Oh, for sure. You know, we call it the Black teacher tax, right? So there is a tax on the fact that when you're the only Black teacher or one of the only Black teachers, you're often relegated to the disciplinarian, especially of Black students or brown and Black students. And also you have to do a lot of, you're suddenly become the cultural expert on everything Black. So it's a really a stressful situation that often brings teachers to not come to the profession, but to leave. And Cynthia, let me just say, it's not like Black teachers are not getting into the profession. The problem is that they're not being retained.
Okay. But as far as getting into the teaching profession, are there unique barriers for Black college students who do want to get into teaching?
Very much so. The college experience is often written from a white female point of view. And sometimes I just had a conversation with a young Black new teacher from the Lansing School District who said, you know, it wasn't until the end of her senior year before she saw a Black professor or had experience with a Black professor. And of course, then when you're doing your student teaching, you're often placed in white schools as well.
More than half of Michigan school districts have no African-American teachers. Why does this matter?
Well, it matters. There are so many studies that show that and Cynthia, I'm going to speak from the Black perspective because I've never been Asian, I promise. So, you know, from Black perspective, you know, there are so many studies that show that when Black students have Black teachers, they're more likely to be more successful academically, their discipline rates tend to be more balanced, and they're more likely to be put in the gifted and talented programs rather than in the special education programs.
Why is that the case?
Well, there's a lot of social norms, I think, that students of color have to adopt to, that sometimes these norms are confusing to young kids, and they're immediately misinterpreted, and they are then put in the discipline track rather than, let's say, in an honors society track. So while their white counterpart might be considered creative and groundbreaking or risk-taking, their Black counterpart might be thought as maybe defiant or violent.
Got it. Matinka, I want to play a clip from a conversation you had with teacher Chris Cadogan, who's a social studies teacher at Lansing Eastern High School in his sixth year of teaching, and he is one of just two Black teachers in the building. So here's what he had to say about what seeing a Black man teaching American history means to his white students.
They get to see two things. Mm-hmm. A, it matters who's telling the story. If the same people are telling the story, then we're going to get the same story. That's a problem. It problematizes that.
Right.
And the second thing, though, is this Black dude who is supposed to be rapping or who is supposed to be playing basketball, who's supposed to be 6'4", is 5'11", and he's wearing an anime costume.
So, Matinka, what is it like to be a teacher of color when you are one of the few in a school? I mean, what's your experience been?
Oh, my gosh. You know, this conversation with Chris was just so rich, and he just had so many things to say. And from my own personal experience, you know, there are some social messages that are very loud and clear when you're the only teacher of color or one of the only teachers of color. And so in my experience, I've had to moderate my opinion and my personality, my self-expression, and really be conscious of my ability to assimilate to the predominant culture. And there's this constant anxiety that people may be thinking, whoa, there goes the neighborhood, right? So however, being a teacher of color also has its positives. You know, I came up in mostly white schools. And so I was always a hyphenated student. So I was always the African-American, the African, the Black student. And being the Black teacher in a mostly white school for those Black students gives me a sense of place. It's an honor to be in a place where you can be that respite for the Black students in your care.
And also be someone present to the white students. Certainly that's what we heard from Chris.
For sure. And like he says, you know, it humanizes, you know, the character that you adopt as a Black teacher in a school that is mostly white, students see firsthand, they see that the Black teacher is a human person.
Not a stereotype.
Not a stereotype. And like Chris and I had these conversations about archetypes. And for him specifically, there is a Black male archetype that is hyper masculine. And when kids see him in his goofy costumes and in his intellectual self, it's an experience that they don't see, let's say, in the media.
All right. So we have a problem. Let's talk about solutions and let's return to your conversation with Chris Cadogan from Lansing Eastern High School.
Teach for America actually does better than most districts
in
recruiting African-Americans, namely because they recruit African-Americans. They go out and say, we need Black teachers. They prioritize it. I don't know that districts spend money on that. And these are districts that have 90% African-Americans.
So it seems Chris is challenging districts to invest in recruiting. What else needs to happen to get more teachers of color into Michigan classrooms?
You know, of course, you know, one of the conversations we had about with Chris was this idea of the teacher pay. And paying teachers is expensive. And I'm saying that in quotation marks. But changing the way that schools are run is not so expensive. And I think sometimes teachers of color lack the autonomy, lack the voice at the table, and they lack a place where they can express themselves. And so to me, it would be easier for schools to just kind of start thinking about how they can manage that so that they can attract more teachers of color. Also, they could start young teachers programs in their schools to just kind of give kids of color that taste of, hey, you know what, this is a profession. Maybe you don't get paid very much, but it's definitely fulfilling and you're really doing something for your community when you become a teacher.
Which actually leads me to ask you, just because you can speak as a Black teacher, what made you want to become a teacher?
Well, I was an accidental teacher. I just kind of came into the profession. I was going to law school. I was going to be this big international lawyer, and then walked into the classroom and decided, whoa, I'm really, really good at this. And, you know, Cynthia, I was not a very good student, but I knew I was a very good learner. And suddenly when I became a teacher, I realized, wow, I can create a world that I wish I would have grown up in when it came to my academic career. So that was what made me stay. And of course, now that I am a consultant working outside of the schools, I'm able to go back inside and continue to create that change. And for me, that's valuable because especially in the age of let's differentiate, let's think about the social construct that these kids are coming from. I am just so incredibly excited that I am in this position right now. I'm the right place at the right time.
Is there something in your experience that tells us what is missing when it comes to getting teachers of color in the classroom?
Yeah, you know, and once again, this social modulation that we have to make, and again, I am always hyper aware of my skin color when I walk into a school that is mostly white. And when I walk into a school that is not mostly white, that cape is taken off. So there's even though race is a social construct, Cynthia, I have more in common biologically with you than I do with a Black male. But it's a social construct. It is still, you know, as a country, historically, we just have not yet moved away from that. But just like in the fashion world and in the film world, we see so many more different varieties of people. You can see how rich that environment has become and how much more interesting, at least from my vantage point, has going to the movies has become, or going into the makeup store, or going into the store to buy just a dress, and how much more variety there is for me. So the world fits better for me when I see people that look like me, you know, in positions of power.
Michigan Radio education contributor Matinga Ragatz on building diversity within the ranks of teachers in our state. Matinga, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Join us tomorrow as we look at the future of manufacturing in Michigan. A recent Brookings survey found most Americans think manufacturing has an uncertain role in our economy going forward.
Manufacturing historically has been a vital part of the American economy. It still can be vital, but we need to invest in worker retraining, in education, and in infrastructure.
That is tomorrow on Stateside. Plus, we will talk with Michigan Congressman and former Republican Justin Amash. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.